you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us this week as I'm joined by film critic Leo Lowenstein and from Cinegods.com, Film Week critic Wade Major. First up this week, Air Courting a Legend, the story of Michael Jordan and the Air Jordan shoe line at Nike. The film stars Matt Damon and the film's director, Ben Affleck. Film's written by Alex Convery. Leo, what'd you think of Air Courting a Legend?
Well, one hesitates to use superlatives because they raise expectations so much, but in this case, they are well-deserved. This is just, you know, again, hesitating to use the sports metaphors, but a slam dunk for Affleck and the entire creative team. This film really shows how, not just how Michael Jordan came to Nike, but also how the athletic shoe industry was forever changed. And even though the ending of the film is a foregone conclusion, we know about the Air Jordans, of course, it still plays kind of suspenseful, like an underdog story, like an underdog sports story. And Matt Damon is just perfect as Sonny Vaccaro, this guy who has to go out on a limb and, in fact, go to North Carolina and seek out, without permission, Michael Jordan's parents, including his mom, played by Viola Davis, just to perfection, and then try, against all odds, to convince them to sign with Nike, because at that point Jordan was going to sign with Adidas, and then Converse was his second choice. Nike was, he wasn't even considering it. Nike was a running shoe company and it didn't even have a chance. And everyone in this film is just so good. Affleck is a director's actor. He knows how to bring out the best in his cast. He's also working with people that he's worked with before, of course, Damon, Jason Bateman, Chris Messina, everyone just bringing their best energy to this. And Affleck also, to his credit, knows how well he works best. He plays off himself. He makes himself the butt of the joke sometimes as the head of the Nike shoe company. And it's just, it works really well, particularly his scenes with Damon. There's this sort of crackling dynamism that reminds us of Good Will Hunting and of their friendship and all of that. And it's just, you know, also want to mention the editing by William Goldenberg, just terrific, keeping everything on point and very finely tuned. You know, this is also the kind of film that you should see with an audience, because there's a lot of crowd-pleasing moments. And for that reason, it's the kind of film that reminded me of why we go to the movies, why we like to see movies in theaters with other people.
Well, and Sonny Vaccaro and Phil Knight are such larger-than-life characters in real life.
Right.
To see this pair, you know, who've acted in so many movies together, portraying them, it's got to be fun for that, too.
And Affleck has said in interviews that he hesitated to work with Damon again for, I don't know, like 20 years or so, because they were thought of as this buddy-buddy team, best friends. And they did have a production company together, Pearl Street, for a number of years. They have a new company, Artist Equity, and this is the first thing from that company. And it's just so great to see those guys together again. It really is. It feels like coming home or something.
What do you think, Wade?
I think Layla is way too critical. I agree.
Dude, don't overhype it or people will get mad.
It is. I love this film. I really love this film. And on so many levels. And it's worth pointing out, our first two films this week are actually, they're almost clones of each other.
They're very similar.
Really, yeah. Similar stuff. And both by writers. This is their first produced screenplay. Alex Convery, first produced screenplay, and it is amazing. It's beautiful.
It's a really good script.
Every character has a life, even right down to Marlon Wayans, who's only in a couple of scenes, but he's fully developed. He's fully three-dimensional. Even, you know, Jason Bateman, who could be really, he's almost kind of a clone of Herb Tarlick from WKRP, until one scene when suddenly his humanity just comes out. And that one scene could very well get him an Oscar nomination if they put, you know, some money behind this at award season later this year. I think it's a wonderful film. And, you know, I've been critical of Ben Affleck as a director in the past. I thought Argo is not quite there. The town wasn't quite there. This is just absolutely right spot on. He gets all the performances right. Viola Davis has moments where the acting, when she's not saying anything, the reacting of the acting is just magnificent. Her eyes, her look, these slight little expressions. It's just an incredibly rich film.
We should mention also that when Affleck went and talked to Michael Jordan about whether he would be okay with this being made, his one condition was that Viola Davis play his mother. And so...
And he got her.
Lucky us, yeah.
Air According a Legend, directed by Ben Affleck, who stars along with Matt Damon and Jason Bateman, Viola Davis, Alex Convery wrote the screenplay. It's rated R. It's in wide release starting Tuesday of next week. Tetris, based on the true story of the video game salesman and his discovery of Tetris back in the late 1980s. Taron Egerton stars in the film with Nikita Efremov. The film's directed by John S. Baird. Noah Pink wrote Tetris. Wade.
I love this movie, too. It might be just a notch below Air because it gets into some very cloak and dagger Cold War stuff that you know, you kind of, okay, they're fabricating a lot here. They're really maybe pushing the dramatization beyond what actually happened. But that said, it's an awful lot of fun. And it's so similar in many respects to Air. It's about a scrappy guy in the 80s who thinks he has, you know, he's trying to go toe-to-toe with the big corporate guys because he's driven by passion. I mean, all of these things. And then, you know, it just happens that one is about an athlete in a shoe. The other one's about a programmer in a game. But the overlap from the 80s is amazing because those two things were ascendant, right? Gaming was ascendant. The NBA was ascendant. And so there is kind of, between these two films, a really interesting historical thing that's being laid out. In this case, Hank Rogers, who is Dutch-born but American-raised, he's just finds Tetris and he wants to get some of the rights, not even all of the rights, just the Japanese rights. His wife's Japanese, his kids are Japanese, you know, he's raising his family there, and he wants the rights to in Japan. And suddenly, next thing you know, he's in Russia, the KGB's chasing him, he's going toe-to-toe with, all of these giant corporate entities, including Robert Maxwell, who is just, you know, this larger-than-life figure here. I mean, it's quite a story.
Tetris is the film, Lael.
Yeah, I'm pretty much right in line with Wade. I enjoyed this a lot, and it did, seeing Air that same day, it made me feel like, wow, there were certain similarities. Of course, this was an era before we had cell phones, before we had PCs, before, you know, really, all of this stuff was nascent, the film really captures the sort of being on the cusp of a technological breakthrough and a breakthrough in gaming. And this guy, played by Taron Egerton, he's right there with it. Egerton, by the way, you know, I don't think we can really say enough about what a good actor he is.
So good. He's such a chameleon.
Right? I mean, Elton John in Rocket Man, Eddie the Eagle in The King. He's been in Kingsman.
Films.
I mean, he's really good. And he's really good here, too. You feel like he's in reinventing himself every time. So I thought this was quite entertaining. I could have done maybe with a little less of the cloak and dagger stuff, of the sort of KGB, you know, like stereotypical, like... Yeah. Russian,
but it's fun to have the Russians as bad guys again. It is. Uh-huh. It feels like the 80s. It's the 80s.
It did. I mean, it did sort of take us back to the 80s, and it was quite entertaining all the way through. Again, not unlike Air, it's a foregone conclusion. You know how it's going to turn out. Tetris is going to be a huge video game, but we don't know how it got there.
And it's the journey.
And the film also manages to navigate a number of complicated things about licensing and world rights and country rights and PC rights and video, like all of that. Sometimes it's a little bit unclear, but you know what? It doesn't matter because it keeps us going.
That's what really amazed me about it, is that there's a lot of talk about remove this clause, add this clause, change this contract. You didn't include this in the contract. Like, it gets into some legalese, and somehow I was riveted, and I still didn't understand it.
Right.
But I was riveted.
Me too.
That's art. Tetris is the film from director John S. Baird, written by Noah Pink. Taron Egerton stars. It's rated R and is streaming on Apple TV Plus. The documentary Unzipped, An Autopsy of American Inequality, is set in Venice, right here in Southern California. The film is directed by Colin K. Gray. Leo, what did you think of the documentary?
I thought this was a really important, powerful, and enlightening documentary to clear up one potential question. The film makes the point that zip code comes from zone improvement plan, and it was implemented in 1963 by the post office. And so Venice, when it got its own zip code, was sort of an area that was designated, you know, as an up and coming area, like people of all different ethnicities. That there were, it was a surfer culture. It was, you know, artists lived there, and so forth. And it was, and it tolerated all. It welcomed all. And now, because of the gentrification of Venice and the surge in the unhoused population, you know, it's become sort of this weird lightning rod for all kinds of different movements, from the Venice United movement, which was objecting to former councilman Mike Bonin's plans for the MTA shelter, for, you know, including interviews with Gil Garcetti, who talks about the homeless problem and how, you know, how he would advise handling it differently. There's all kinds of experts. Of course, you know, the film is a little bit dated because Karen Bass is now our mayor and Bone is not there anymore. But it's a film that is highly topical, also very enlightening because it follows a number of these different homeless people on their journey. A family, a black family with two children under two and one on the way, and you know, and how they got cast out in the streets, and you know, and an artist who was also cast out, and then there are others as well too, meth users and so forth. But it's a very sort of humanitarian film, and it really makes you consider, I don't know, kind of all sides of the issue, I think, and deeply important for all of us to see. It gives a really good overview of the history of Venice all the way through the present day.
We're talking about the documentary Unzipped, An Autopsy of American Inequality. Wade.
Yeah, this is a very well-made doc. I think my only complaint would be that I think the filmmakers editorialize a little too much where they don't need to. You know, they have a lot of those superimpositions that give us statistics. This many people, this, you know, this happened and these people did this and so forth. And I don't think it quite needed all of that. I think the interviews were enough to sort of let us take what we will take from it. But, you know, it also has things like, you know, Mike Bonin, it doesn't discuss his recall. It doesn't discuss Mark Ridley Thomas is interviewed. He's having his own legal problems. So some of, if you live here and you know some of that, I think that takes away from some of the authoritative voices that they're trying to present. But the profiles of the people, the families and the art, the family and the artist. I mean, these are compelling stories. And they don't do the thing that always drives me crazy in documentaries, which is just, you know, present the one side. They really do. Even though it's clear the filmmakers have a point of view, they go to the realtors and they go to the local business people and the homeowners associations, and they let them air their point of view. And so it really does give you as comprehensive a look at the whole problem as I think is probably possible in 90 minutes.
Yeah, and it's also, I wouldn't call it a downer. I mean,
no, it's
not.
There's
a little bit of hope in there, and you know, there's little moments of grace and hope and light, and I just think it's an important film for everyone to see, both to sort of reconsider their own context and what they have and how lucky they are, and also sort of what, you know, what is going on with the homeless situation.
I mean, the big
things.
The big debate is, you know, is it a housing issue, or is it a drug addiction problem, or is it some combination of the two?
Or is it a mental health issue?
Or is it a mental health issue?
And it's all of the above.
And wherever you fall on that, there's information here and there are stories here that you do need to make a part of your understanding.
Now, you mentioned a Garcetti in the film. Did you mean former Mayor Eric Garcetti?
Yes.
Was
yes,
interviewed?
I did, Larry.
Okay.
Thanks.
That's all right. It's part of being a longtime Angeleno. You mentioned his father, Gil. That's all right. That's okay. Unzipped, An Autopsy of American Inequality. The film is unrated. It's at Lemley's Monica Film Center in Santa Monica, appropriately playing in the community next door to Venice. Coming up on Film Week, we'll hear what our critics have to say about Dungeons and Dragons, Honor Among Thieves, that film starring Hugh Grant and Chris Pine, Michelle Rodriguez in the cast as well. And we have another documentary. This one's getting a fair amount of attention, featuring Brooke Shields talking about her life and her earliest acting experiences, including in the Louis Malle film Pretty Baby, in which she was, I believe, only 11 years old when she acted in that film, which was set in a New Orleans brothel right after the turn of the 20th century. century. So Shields talks about her life and how sexualized she was as even preteen in her early acting career. Those films and more to be reviewed by our critics, Wade Major and Leo Lowenstein, when we come back on Film Week on LAist 89.3. We remind you, you can listen to the program on your schedule wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
It's Film Week on LAist 89.3 with critics Leo Lowenstein and Wade Major. The adventure fantasy film Dungeons & Dragons, Honor Among Thieves, stars Hugh Grant, Chris Pine, and Michelle Rodriguez. The film is directed by John Francis Daley and Jonathan Goldstein. They also wrote the screenplay with Michael Giglio. Wade, what did you think?
Not much. This is so terrible. And so much money was spent on it. This is yet another chapter in the ongoing adventure of Paramount and Hasbro trying to turn every Hasbro property into a movie universe or a movie franchise. And since 1997, Hasbro has had Dungeons & Dragons. They'd made one attempt at making a franchise out of it about 20 years ago. That belly flopped. So here we go again. And it's the same problem. This is kind of like a third-tier Lord of the Rings knockoff. And you can't really take a role-playing game, which I grew up with. You know, I remember when this when I was a kid, tons of kids doing this, like in Stranger Things. And it just doesn't lend itself to a movie. It's a game. It's a role-playing game. It's dice and, you know, kids sitting around a table. And here, they've just fabricated something that really has next to nothing to do with the game. It's just the name. Chris Pine plays kind of a guy whose life has fallen apart. He's become a thief because his wife died, and then his child is sort of in a thievery scheme. His child winds up, you know, being adopted by Hugh Grant, and when he gets out of prison or escapes from prison with Michelle Rodriguez, he realizes he's now disconnected, and he has to go on a hero's quest, and none of it makes sense. It's kind of being everything. They make up everything as they go along. The creatures, the plot twists, it all just kind of falls into place a little bit too haphazardly. And there's nothing compelling about the characters. The world building is not very interesting. And the magic and all the things that would normally be characterized by, you know, that they're part of the D&D lore, none of that is very original either. So it just feels like kind of a cheap knockoff that they're trying to, like a toy franchise they're trying to exploit for money. And it doesn't work.
Dungeons & Dragons Honor Among Thieves is rated PG-13 in wide release. The documentary Pretty Baby Brooke Shields, directed by Lana Wilson. Lael.
This is a thoughtful and thorough examination of the career of Brooke Shields, who I'm not sure too many young people would really even know that much about her today. But at the time, in the 80s, she was an influencer before there were influencers. She was an icon. She was one of the most photographed people in the world. And of course, there was all kinds of scandal about the fact that she was in a movie directed by Louis Malle, Pretty Baby, which was set in a brothel in New Orleans, and there was some nudity and so forth. She also was known for having this very controlling mother who was her manager, Terry Shields. And she was also known later for coming out with a book when she dropped out of Hollywood kind of and went to college, went to Princeton, and wrote briefly in the book, although it became a huge flashpoint, that she was maintaining her virginity and had planned to wait until she was married to lose it. And The film does a really good job of contextualizing Shields by pointing out, both through her own recollections and reflections, through the use of extensive use of video footage, and the filmmaker was really lucky to have gotten access to this incredible treasure trove of video. What her experiences on interview shows, talk shows. I mean, she's interviewed by like Mike Douglas and Merv Griffin, and there are moments where it's almost like, it's not quite a lecherous male gaze, but there's a male gaze, and she is very aware that now, looking back, that she was sort of being positioned for that. But at the time, you know, she was just sort of playing along with it. Some of the experts who talk about, you know, gender issues and sexuality and so forth talk about the fact that she was, actually there's a woman from BuzzFeed talks about the fact that Brooke Shields was either a vessel or vector for over-sexualization and sexploitation of children, or for prudishness and virginity and this other kind of movement, and the fact that people sort of cast whatever feelings they had onto Shields at the time. And she was just this girl who was growing up and was trying to navigate this industry. What struck me as interesting was she doesn't regret the decisions that she made or working with her mother, the way her mother sort of, you know, overmanaged her career. But her mother was an alcoholic, and that's what Brooke really regrets, is the time that she was pushed around by her mother during the alcoholic rages and so forth. She then went on to, of course, marry Andre Agassi, who's played as a sort of another almost controlling relationship. When she got out of that, she ended up married to a screenwriter with two girls who she's raising. And she seems very grounded. She seems very kind of whole and thoughtful and reflective. There is a disclosure of a sexual abuse that was sort of shocking. But I thought it was just a really, really interesting look at someone who I considered a contemporary and was probably a little bit envious of growing up, and was, it was good to see her grounded and doing well. And also, she lets herself show her lines on her face in her interviews now, which I really appreciated. I like that.
Pretty Baby Brooke Shields, the documentary from Lana Wilson. It's streaming on Hulu starting next Monday. It's unrated. The crime thriller One Day as a Lion stars J.K. Simmons, Scott Kahn. It's directed by John Swab and written by Scott Kahn, who's one of the stars of the film. Wade?
I was pleasantly surprised by this. I think it's the best thing Scott Kahn's ever done, and he wrote it for himself. And he's looking so much like his dad. He even walks
James
like his
Kahn,
dad.
Yeah.
It's really almost kind of creepy. This is made by Grindstone through their deal with Lionsgate, and those are typically kind of just these factory product action thrillers and action comedies, and they come out with a ton of them. Occasionally they're about talking animals. But, you know, Grindstone is a factory, so most of these movies don't typically really rise above, you know, barely average. This one I really thought had some moments. Scott Kahn plays an ex-boxer who accepts a hitman job that he's really not qualified for because he doesn't want to kill anybody, but he kind of owes this mobster played by Frank Grillo a debt, so he's supposed to go kill a guy, which is, you know, J.K. Simmons, and it doesn't go well because J.K. Simmons is sort of this urban cowboy who's not having it, and he packs a gun, and Scott Kahn is only doing this because he's trying to get a lawyer for his son who's wrongly in jail. Long story short, he winds up kind of on the lam with this waitress whom he kidnaps, but they wind up basically becoming very close, and they're, you know, she has a backstory as well and an issues with her mom. And it becomes this sort of romantic comedy slash action comedy. And somehow I really fell in love with the characters. Even if it was going through some pretty predictable beats, I just really enjoyed being in the company of these actors.
One Day as a Lion.
Yeah, I liked the scenes with Marion Rendon and Scott Kahn more than the other scenes.
I agree.
Thought they had actual chemistry, and I thought
she is amazing.
She is terrific.
She's great.
I didn't know her, but she's really good, Marion Rendon. And also, we should mention Virginia Madsen has one or two scenes as her mom, just really terrific, hamming it up, but just right. And just a real strong cast. I thought the actors were maybe a little bit better than the script, but you know, it's a decent effort, and it was entertaining, and it's kind of fun in parts, particularly their scenes together.
All right, One Day as a Lion. It's rated R. It's in select theaters starting next Tuesday, and later next week, it's available on demand. Rye Lane is a British romantic comedy starring David Johnson and Vivian Opara. The film's directed by Rain Alan Miller, written by Nathan Bryan and Tom Malia. Wade, what'd you think of Rye Lane?
So I wasn't fond of it as it started. It's a little bit too stylish and tricked up, and it felt I thought, okay, what they're going for is kind of like a South London cross between She's Gotta Have It and Before Sunrise. And you've got these two kids played by David Johnson, Vivian Opara, who kind of come together and they don't like each other very much, and they're having these bad breakups, but they're, you know, over the course of this one night, they kind of grow together, and there are some other little tangential stories to it. But as this movie went along, I really fell in love with both of them. I think they're two terrific performers. Their chemistry is wonderful. And there are some really sweet, sensitive, very surprising scenes, especially a karaoke scene that is just wonderful. It's just magical. And that's what Rain Alan Miller is a very talented director. I hope she understands that when she's not playing with the camera and doing some of these tricky things, when it's just, you know, meat and potatoes, actors and human emotions, that's where she really shines. So she doesn't need all the rest of that stuff. She can really fine tune it. I do, however, wish that this were in theaters. It's going to Hulu from Searchlight. This is the kind of independent film I think that really belongs in theaters.
And in the past would have had a theatrical release.
It would
before
have.
The pandemic, wouldn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, it would have.
Rye Lane, R-Y-E. Lane is the film. It's rated R. And as Wade just mentioned, it's streaming on Hulu. The romantic comedy sci-fi film Space Oddity stars Kevin Bacon, Kyle Allen, and Alexandra Shipp. It's directed by Kira Sedgwick, making her feature directorial debut. Rebecca Banner is the screenwriter. Lael, what did you think of Space Oddity?
Well, there are some very sweet things in this film, and some lovely little performances. Kevin Bacon as the dad of Kyle Allen is very strong, and I thought also Carrie Preston as the mom. It's a story about grief and how different people process their grief, but it doesn't really explain what the source of the grief is initially. You kind of have to figure that out through the story. So Kyle Allen is a young man who decides that he's going to quit his engineering program and go on a mission to Mars, because I think it's sort of set maybe a little bit in the future, on a private mission, because Mars is being colonized, and it's a one-way mission, so he's not going to come back. And he tells his family that he's done, he's giving up on life here, and he's done, and giving up on their flower farm. And then he meets an insurance agent who's played by Alexander Shipp, and they start to have a little chemistry, and he maybe kind of starts to maybe reconsider if he wants to leave. So there's some sweet moments. It's a little quirky, a little weird, but you know, it's got some sweet moments.
And the title is Space Oddity.
Yeah. So. Oh yeah. And you do hear the song too.
All right.
Yeah. It's sweet and it's charming. It's a little bit lacking in dramatic punch. It's sort of more meditative and I think maybe allegorical in some respects. But you know, I mean, I didn't dislike it.
Space Oddity is rated PG-13 in select theaters, also available on demand. And our John Horn talks with first-time feature director Kira Sedgwick, of course, extremely well-known actor with a long career in film and television. That's coming right up. Murder Mystery 2 stars Adam Sandler and Jennifer Aniston. Jeremy Gerlich directed. James Vanderbilt wrote the screenplay of the action mystery comedy. Wade?
I would like to thank the people who made this film for absolving me of any desire to see Murder Mystery 1. I did not prepare by seeing the first one, and I'm quite glad. So Adam Sandler and Jennifer Aniston are this really crusty New York couple who can't stop fighting and they solve crimes. It's kind of like if you know, Heart to Heart had an attitude. And they're not very good at it either. They're really kind of inept, but somehow they bumble their way through it. And it just doesn't work. It's just bad jokes that fall flat, and it's crime thriller, whodunit situations that don't make sense, and things come from left field, and reversals happen for no reason, and I just don't know why there's a second one. I really don't.
This formula, there's still nothing beats The Thin Man.
No. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Nick and Nora, right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, Leo.
You know, this, as much as I loved Air, that's how much I hated Murder Mystery 2. This is trying to be a screwball farce mystery thriller, like Knives Out with a touch of Murder on the Orient Express, and Wade bringing in the 80s references, sticking with our theme, with Heart to Heart. Yeah, it was absolutely unbearable. It feels phoned in. What an uninspired vanity project. They throw in a Bollywood dance number for no real reason. It winds up on the Eiffel Tower for no reason.
I don't even understand that. And I mean, you know, Melanie Laurent, who is an amazing actress and a great director in her own right, totally wasted. Legendary French comic Danny Boone, who has directed, you know, some of the greatest comedies and most successful comedies on his own in France.
Yeah.
He's just kind of in this weird throwaway role. I mean, you know, if you're going to get that caliber of French talent, do something with them.
It feels very disengaged. The characters feel disengaged, the actors from their environment, from each other, from any story. It just feels empty.
Why is Mark Strong even in this movie?
I don't know. It's like this represents what Netflix does wrong. It does many things right, but this represents what it does wrong.
Murder Mystery 2, the action mystery comedy, is streaming on Netflix. It's rated PG-13, starring Adam Sandler and Jennifer Aniston. Coming up, as I mentioned, our John Horn in conversation with actor and now director Kira Sedgwick. It's Film Week on LAist 89.3 and available wherever you get your podcasts, so you can listen to our critics whenever it's convenient for you. We'll be right back.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. For most of her professional career, Kira Sedgwick's been an actor. Her credits include the TV crime series The Closer, for which she won an Emmy, and the police comedy show Brooklyn Nine-Nine. She starred in the movies Born on the 4th of July, Singles, and The Edge of 17. Now she's directed her first feature film, Space Oddity. It's the story of a young man who says he's preparing to travel to Mars, which could be a fantasy or not. What is true is the young man and his family are trying to deal with a tragic loss. Our John Horn spoke with her earlier this week about making her first feature film and why she was drawn to the story.
Kira, hi. Great to see you. And I'm looking forward to talking about your movie.
Thank you so much. Thrilled to be here.
There is, in the Olympics, if you're doing diving, a degree of difficulty. I don't know if it goes from 1 to 4 or whatever it is, but the higher the difficulty, the harder the dive. And I have the same rule for movies and executive producers. The more executive producers there are, the harder it was to get the movie made. I lost count at 15. Maybe there are more. But if you use the Olympic executive producer degree of difficulty rule, this was not an easy movie to get financed.
It was not an easy movie to get financed. Yeah, which is kind of, I don't know why it continued to shock me, even though we got no's from so many people, because I just thought, this is such a beautiful script. This is actually about something. This takes you on this emotional journey. It's funny. It's sad. It's hopeful. Like, what's the problem?
What was the problem when you were shopping it around? Was there a common excuse, or what did they say?
I think what people said was it's execution driven. And I thought, are they kidding? Isn't everything execution driven? I mean, I was so confused by that comment. I mean, I think that people really loved the script, but I don't, maybe execution driven is, I don't know if she can direct it and I don't know if she can get a decent cast. I mean, I think that's probably the, you know, as I see you nodding your head, I'm feeling less alone in the world.
I think execution driven is code for, we don't think you can pull this off. It's not even a polite way of saying no. It's basically just saying we don't think you have it in you.
Let me just tell you that I'm really glad that you and I didn't talk about this while I was getting the no's, because then I would feel even worse than I did when they said no.
So in the face of so many no's, what made you convinced that it still had to be a yes for you?
Because I feel like it has a lot of relevance. And I think that I think it has relevance because it is a movie about something. And I think it has relevance because it's very entertaining, because you are really taken on an emotional journey, as I mentioned, and you get to have all the feels, and yet it's about important things like depression, like loss, like climate, like why is this 24-year-old wanting to go to Mars in the first place? You know, and the ways in which he wants to check out, and the ways in which his whole family wants to check out, and then you find out why, and then you understand, and then the joy of seeing them all one by one realize that they need to keep the focus on themselves and not on, you know, the person who seems to be suffering the most or seems to have the most explosive outburst. And that's the way to freedom and connection for all of this and healing, all of them and healing. And for me, it's very much a story about how do we fall back in love with being alive? How do we fall back in love with being on this earth and knowing that they're, even with all the struggles and even with loss and even with climate change and even with all of it, that the fight is worth fighting here on this planet. And to me, it had all that in a bag of chips. And I just thought, damn, I got to make this thing, you know?
Rebecca Banner's screenplay appeared on the Blacklist, which is Franklin Leonard's curated list of unproduced screenplays back, I think, in 2016. And I think it came to you, I want to say, even before the pandemic. Was this one of those things that as you're trying to raise money and being told it is execution dependent, meaning we don't think you can make it, that that you are having to deal not only with putting together money, but also dealing with how are you going to shoot it as everything starts to shut down?
Exactly. I mean, I think we got the movie in 2018. In March of 2020, we were location scouting on, you know, our own dime. And I found Wickford. It was the perfect town for the movie. And of course, then the world shut down and we were going to make it that summer, and we weren't obviously able to for another year. But really, I think that, yes, trying to raise the money will always be difficult. But the truth is, you know, having an extra year to prep in my mind and to cast it well and to try to get the money was helpful. And also to dial in the script more and more and more.
Was it something that you always saw yourself directing? And was it ever something you saw yourself directing and acting in, or was it either or?
No, I mean, I always thought if it would help financially, I would play the mom, but I didn't want to. No, I very much wanted to direct it from the moment I read it.
When you are directing other actors, it's often true that you can remember how other directors got performances out of you and how other directors didn't get performances out of you, emulate what worked and avoid what didn't. But so many actors have different ways of approaching character and being prepared. How do you make sure that what works for you as an actor might not work for the actors you're directing? How do you find a common language? Because so many actors have different ways of approaching their work.
I mean, I think it's just a total crapshoot. I think it's, you know, you try one thing, if it doesn't work, you try another thing. I mean, I still think it's one of the hardest things about directing is getting great performances. Well, the wonderful thing about being an actor is indeed what you just said, which is that I've seen a lot of directors do it badly. So I know, I don't think I'll ever be that bad as some of them were, but I also can fall into the same traps that some of them do. But I do think that, you know, I have a really great thing going for me as an actor director, which is that all the actors know that I know what it's like when you say action, that I know how vulnerable that feels, that I know how alone you feel in that moment. And I think that helps actors to open their hearts to me more faster than anybody else. I earn their trust faster. And that helps me to take them to places that they might not necessarily feel safe going otherwise.
When you think about directing, does it feel like all of your work as an actor and directing in television led you to this moment? Do you wish you'd started earlier, or does it feel like it was the right time and it needed to wait?
Yeah, it's so funny, right? It's like, I don't look back and regret that I didn't start earlier, but boy, I waited an awfully long time. I mean, I directed for the first time when I was 50. What I felt like when I directed for the first time, you know, 7 or 8 years ago, was, wow, this is what I've been preparing to do. That whole crazy acting thing was the thing I was, you know, doing to prepare me for what I really should be doing, which is directing. But the truth is, you know, I think that my secret sauce is my acting, is all the history that I've had, and all the many directors I've worked with, and all the mediums I've worked with on. So I think those things are ultimately great gifts. And how wonderful to start something quote unquote new when you're 50. I mean, what a gift. Like, who gets that, you know? And to be a bigger part of the storytelling, something that I've always loved to do as an actor, where you're only one small part and suddenly you're in charge of the whole thing and in charge of what the audience sees at every moment. It couldn't have come at a better time, really.
One of the difficulties of working during the pandemic is casting, that you may not be meeting people in person. You might be casting over Zoom, and you might be casting individually and just crossing your fingers that when people come together, they have some sort of rapport or chemistry. How difficult is that when you are casting virtually, and what were your workarounds? How did you figure out whether or not this would all come together as an ensemble as opposed to individual actors who looked good by themselves?
You know, it was looking at tape and not reading people, you know. I didn't audition these young actors, and I got really lucky. So I think it was really difficult, and it was a lot of cross your fingers and hope a lot. I also knew from watching their work that, you know, they were good listeners, which I think is really important. I mean, it's such a huge part of acting that we don't really think about. And it was hard, yes, indeed.
You're listening to our John Horn in conversation with actor and now director Kira Sedgwick of the new film Space Oddity. We'll have more of their conversation when we come back in just a minute. It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. Let's get right back to John Horn's conversation with actor Kira Sedgwick, who's the director of the new film Space Oddity.
When you were casting the actor who plays the father in this film, did he go all prima donna and said, "I'm not auditioning, I'm just taking an offer"? What were those conversations?
I know, it was impossible.
For people who don't know, who plays that character?
Kevin Bacon plays the father in the film. And, you know, we had another actor.
Is this true? Did you have another actor?
Yes, we did. We had another actor. And I'll tell you why I didn't ask him first. And it really is that I just didn't want to keep going to that well. He was in my first movies, Story of a Girl. And I just thought, I don't want him to feel like, wow, you know, she can't get anything done on her own, so she needs me. So I didn't want to, you know, and then when I asked him, he said, "I was wondering what took you so long."
Did he know that he was the second choice? Did you let him know that, or is that a secret?
Of course he knew, because he knew who the first choice was and who, you know, loved the script and got back to me right away and, you know, all the things. Because of course, as you know, I mean, when you're married and there's two actors there, you're riding every wave with them, you know.
There's a moment in the film, and I won't get into specifics, where Kevin's character is talking about how he hopes he did right as a parent and how he fears he might not have. And that's a conversation that any honest parent has with himself or herself or themselves. And it feels incredibly honest. I know Kevin's a great actor, but I want to ask you about that day and about having your husband have that conversation that probably you might have had about your own kids and about being parents. Do you remember that day and what it felt like?
He was extraordinary in that moment. But I do think that it is a parent's worst nightmare, that you're going to turn around and realize in the depth of your soul that, you know, you really may have blown it. And I think that that's something that I know I live in fear of 100%. I think it's a very vulnerable place to be, and I'm glad you pointed it out, because I think that it's probably a developmental phase on some level that all parents go through, you know?
Well, and they may not say it publicly or out loud, but they might feel it. I think if they're honest, they do.
Of course. Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, I do wonder that often.
And you also have a composer whose last name rhymes with bacon. Can you tell us about his work?
So Travis has scored everything I've made so far. He scored my first movie, and he scored my short, and then he scored this. He had a partner on this one, Scott Hendrick, and I think that they made an extraordinary, fresh score, and they worked incredibly hard on it, of course, and you know, that's the good and the bad of having your mom. You know, I think they worked on it probably longer than, you know, they would have expected, because they gave us a lot of, you know, a lot of music to cut with. I've sort of been spoiled by that. I've never had a temp track on anything I've done, for that reason, you know, because Travis has always written something for me to use in the cut. And I think that's wonderful, but it also can make for a very long journey for the composers. I think he's incredibly talented. I'm amazed at all the different things he can do. And it was an absolute pleasure.
By the time this interview airs, this report will have come out from UCLA's Hollywood Diversity Report. They have a new study about who gets hired in front of and behind the camera. Let me tell you the numbers for female directors. They're not good. This looked at the top 200 English language films of 2022 based on global box office. And the percentage of those films that were directed by women, drum roll please, 14.6%. So you can do the math. That's 1.5 out of every 10 theatrical films had a female director. And maybe that comes back to this whole idea of this movie being execution dependent, that there is such a built-in bias against women making movies, and women, obviously, well, not everybody knows this, they're more than 50% of the population, 50.1 or something. And yet we're still where we are, where only 14.6% of the jobs go to women. If you look at budgets too, it's like a huge drop off that women, when they get hired, get very small budgets and not a lot of resources.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's very depressing. It's disheartening. And I want to say that I'm able to direct, and I directed my movie, and I continue to direct TV, and I feel lucky, and I think that we can all do better. And I do think there's an inherent bias, and I think we very much live in a patriarchy, but that's not new to anybody, at least not for women. It's not new. The thing that upsets me most of all, almost, is that, you know, so a woman can be considered a great director, but if she makes a movie that doesn't do well, you know, it's really hard for her to get another shot, whereas men continue to fail upwards. So I find that disheartening and discouraging too. And then they wonder why women are risk averse. You
right,
know what I mean?
Right. So the director's jail sentence is much longer for women. What's interesting as well in the UCLA study is that if the director is a woman or a person of color or both, and if the writer is a woman or a person of color or both, the cast is going to be much more diverse.
Yeah. Yep.
Here's something else that's true. Your movie is going to go into, I don't know what this is, a movie theater? What have you heard of that? A multiplex? How did that come about? And I suspect that's important to you.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's only a week. They literally, even if everybody in the world went, they would not extend, which is a little sad. But no, for sure. I mean, look, you know, I'm a child of the 70s. You know, and the great films of that time in the 80s and the 90s. And I mean, you know, you go to the movies, you sit in a dark room together, you breathe together, you laugh together, you cry together, you get scared together. To me, it's a communal experience. It's a huge part of why I do what I do is to exercise empathy, and exercising empathy in a group is just, it's one of our greatest assets as humans, you know, one of our greatest, just it's, So to me, having that opportunity is wonderful, even though it's small, you know, it's small but mighty. And this film for me talks about a lot of really important things. And I love the idea that people are going to get to experience it together.
When you leave a movie or a TV show as a performer, you often take away something professionally, artistically, however you want to define it. When you left this movie, did you take away something personally?
100%. I like to feel like the things that I am giving my time to serve a greater purpose and the greater good. I know that, so for me, the messages of the movie are very much the way that we made the movie. You know, we treaded very lightly on that flower farm. We treaded lightly on that earth. We left good vibes in the wake. We talked about, you know, important things. And I think that I feel more in love with the planet than I ever have.
That's our John Horn in conversation with Kira Sedgwick, director of the new film Space Oddity. It's in select theaters and available on demand. And if you missed what our critics had to say about the film, just head over to LAist.com where you can listen to full episodes of Film Week anytime. It's also available wherever you get your podcasts. From all of us at Film Week, have a wonderful weekend.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of How to LA, a podcast that is a love letter to Los Angeles. Independent movie theaters are having a glow-up moment.
Vidi, it's an Eagle Rock amazing. We have our friends at the American Cinematheque. The Vista just reopened.
In our new series, Revival House, we'll take you inside these spots and share their history. Because movie history is LA history. Listen to Revival House on How to LA wherever you listen to podcasts.